and welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about Lost Horizon by James Hilton. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Kat Bab Magira. She's the author of Poe for Your Problems, Uncommon Advice from History's Least Likely Self-Help Guru, and she's podcasted with us previously on Edgar Allan Poe and Kingsley Amis. She joins us by Skype as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Kat, welcome back to the Great Books Podcast.
Thanks so much. Thrilled to be here.
Why is Lost Horizon by James Hilton a great book?
I'm glad you asked. Lost Horizon is a lost classic. It's a novel that changed the world and was so successful at doing so that we have forgotten all about it. It's the ultimate utopian novel, giving us the term Shangri-La, which people nowadays understand without ever having read the book itself. The novel has also almost literally moved mountains, coming to the attention of FDR in the U.S. and the Chinese government, inspiring one of the greatest films ever made by one of the greatest ever directors, helping to create multi-billion dollar waves of tourism to Tibet, and becoming, for better and for worse, a kind of foundational text in the relationship of the West to the East and the East to the West. The scale of its commercial success is simply astounding, but even more than that, its effect on the global lexicon and the language it's given us for human longing and our highest ideals, that has expanded what it is possible for us to say and express. It's a very complex work, and yet it's simple to read, so much so that thousands and thousands of GIs in World War II read it for leisure, for pleasure. You don't need a PhD to get a thrill out of this book, even as it raises some of the biggest questions in art and life. Does paradise exist? If it did exist, could we stay there? Why do we search for meaning? Why do we locate rest and peace elsewhere, always over the next hill, instead of where we are right now? Is there any escape from the fleeting nature of time, love, of life itself? When you have a novel that does all this while also being absolutely beautifully written, I think you've got a biggie on your hands.
We're going to talk about all that, the adventure story, whether this is a novel of ideas, the remarkable setting. Everybody knows the term Shangri-La. They may not know it comes from this book. Also, movies, Tibet, and a lot more. Kat, let's just start with how the book starts. There's a framing narrative. The book begins with a dinner in Berlin. First of all, tell us, what is a framing narrative, and then how does this one work in Lost Horizon?
Sure. It's basically the structure of a novel in which a story is introduced with a particular device at the beginning, and in this case, it's a meeting of these old school friends in Berlin, and they begin to discuss this thing that has happened to someone whom they all knew.
So it's a story within a story, and at this dinner in Berlin, a novelist who's called Rutherford remembers a story about a guy called Hugh Conway. What does he say about Hugh Conway?
Rutherford says, and the rest of the people in this meeting agree, that Conway was a school hero. When they were at boarding school, he was the greatest athlete, he was great looking, he was extremely smart, he was capable in every sense, and all the other boys looked up to him. So he was really kind of almost an apex figure in this era of British culture. And yet he's had an unusual career. People thought that he would be much more successful than he would have been. And there's an explanation given for this, essentially that his experience of World War I was so traumatic and troubling that it really changed the course of his life and changed his personality to make it, I don't know exactly what you'd say, less straightforwardly ambitious, no less searching, but somewhat incomprehensible to his peers.
Lost Horizon was published in 1933, so between World War I and World War II, and the story takes place in the shadow of World War I, especially through this figure of Hugh Conway. It also looks forward to World War II, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But there's a story then about Conway at this dinner in Berlin where they talk about the discovery of this guy and the finding of him in an unexpected place.
Yeah, the way it comes about is that they're all aware of this incident in the airfield when a town in Persia was being evacuated because of local political unrest. Conway and three other people board a plane, not realizing that the plane has been hijacked, and they're headed off to parts unknown for a mysterious purpose.
And now this is our first setting of the book. Well, there's Berlin in the framing narrative, but then we hear the story. The story of Lost Horizon really gets underway then with this manuscript that Conway has supposedly left behind, and we hear about this town or city called Baskul, Baskul. Sounds kind of like Kabul. It's a little unclear about exactly where it is. Central Asia somewhere, I guess. This is a made up place, isn't it?
Well, I'm not entirely sure that it is. This is the days of the British Raj, you know, that which lasted about 100 years between about 1850 and 1950, where the holdings of the British Empire spanned from southern Iran all the way over to Myanmar and parts east even. So there's this kind of a sprawling British presence in the region. And if you look up Baskul, it's in what we would call modern day Iran. And there was legitimate political strife going on between the British government and the Persian people at this time, some disputes over oil fields, which will probably not surprise anyone. So there is a historical and geographical basis for it.
So Hugh Conway is a British consul in Baskul. I guess he's a diplomat assigned to this area, and he has to flee along with a few other people, and they hop on a plane. What are they fleeing from, and where are they trying to go?
There is a kind of local political unrest that is turning violent. So they're attempting to evacuate to Peshawar, or what's now known as Pakistan, or an area in Pakistan. And they believe that the pilot is on their side. It does not turn out to go that way. The plane has been hijacked by a Tibetan who has been specially trained for this sort of bizarre mission, but to bring these people to Shangri-La.
Okay, and so they get on this plane. They at first they think they're headed to Peshawar, but pretty soon it becomes clear they're not. They wind up in this completely different place. They don't know where they are, and there's a crash landing in this mountainous area.
Yes, and it's an extremely remote area. This is not the Himalayas. It's the Kunlun Mountains that border China, and quite a mysterious area even to this day. So Conway and his fellows have no idea where they're being taken or for what purpose, which helps make this kind of an adventure novel. You have the first 20% of the book taking place during this hijacked flight, and it's quite high adrenaline, even as Conway reveals himself to be a pretty capable leader within this context.
So Conway, Hugh Conway is our hero. He's our protagonist. He's this war-weary veteran, this diplomat who is on the run from Baskul. He has three companions with him, a guy called Charles Mallinson, who's a sort of deputy vice consul or something like that to Conway, a guy called Henry Barnard, who is an American, maybe a guy with some secrets, and then Miss Roberta Brinklow, who is a missionary in the area. So you got these four people together, and they find themselves in this bizarre place. They have no idea where they are, at least not a good sense of where they are. What happens?
Yeah, it's a sort of motley crew. They don't necessarily have a lot in common, though Mallinson and Conway will have the most in common of anyone in their pre-existing, their friendship going into this. So they essentially crash land in this remote area of Tibet. And before too long, so the pilot dies. Before too long, these emissaries come out from a local lamasery to greet the visitors and invite them to come and shelter in their remote monastery, essentially.
So what is a lamasery?
So a lama is a Buddhist monk, and a lamasery is a monastery for Buddhist monks.
I think we've seen pictures of this kind of thing before in Tibet, in mountainous Tibet, these monasteries. They have a distinct architectural look. Do Hugh Conway and his friends now realize that they're in Tibet or near it?
They do. Conway is familiar enough with Asia to recognize some landmarks and architecture so that he's able to sort of have a grasp on the situation before anyone else does. He also speaks a number of Asian languages, so he's able to communicate or at least understand what is being said far more than anyone else on this venture.
Now, the major figure they meet after the plane crash is this guy called Chang. Who is Chang?
Chang is a representative from Shangri-La. He essentially works for the High Lama. He has come down to welcome Conway, and he'll act as the go-between helping to settle this new party of people. And they deal with him throughout the novel. And he's a somewhat mysterious figure. They can't quite tell if he's dealing with them in a straightforward way or if he's holding back crucial information. And it really tends to come out that he has withheld some very significant information from the travelers.
He is enigmatic, I think, is a good word to describe him. And one of the things he does is he keeps trying to put them off with their requests, like, we got to get out of here. How are we going to get home? And Chang keeps not quite answering their questions and discouraging them from leaving this place they find themselves in.
Yes, he conceals for as long as it's possible to conceal the fact that no one is allowed to leave Shangri-La once they arrive there, or at least they're not supposed to. And when they ask him directly, he just continually demurs until Conway eventually speaks to the High Lama, who lets him know what the rules really are.
Okay, so they do get then to the Lamasery, and a lot of the book takes place in the Lamasery, a lot of conversations with Chang there. And it's a strange place for a lot of reasons. I thought almost hilariously, they discover there's a bathtub in it that was built in Akron, Ohio, of all places. And it feels like a joke, but I wonder if there's a point to it as well.
I think it kind of plays into the paradise that Hilton envisions. It has some contact with the outside world, but it's a very limited contact. And I like this about it because you can expect the modern plumbing in Shangri-La and such niceties as well-built bathtubs, and yet the outside world isn't able to reach you with concern or news that might depress you. It's a very limited mode of contact.
And Shangri-La, then, is a kind of sanctuary. Is it a utopia? Is it a paradise? What's so attractive about it?
Well, two ways that Hilton describes it in the novel are as a strange ultimate dream, and another time as a landlocked harbor. It is a paradise that he is portraying. It is a kind of utopia, and this builds on, at least in English, a 500-year history of utopian novels and utopian writings. And there was a tradition like that in Tibet as well, where in Tibetan culture, there's a word for a mythical perfect nation, which actually resembles the word Shangri-La too. So there's been a lot of scholarship on that point. You won't be surprised to hear. In terms of it being a paradise, you know, paradise is not a new concept to us. Neither is the Fountain of Youth. Arguably, these are old ideas. And the fact that they span cultures, I think, shows us something important about human nature, that we're always able to conceive of a better place than we actually live in. So Lost Horizon is building on this and perfecting it in a sense. To describe Shangri-La particularly, it's this beautiful valley high in the mountains. It's distant, it's inaccessible, and there you can live in total peace and security amidst beautiful surroundings with modern conveniences, and yet you're separate enough from the world that you're not being exposed to constant sadness and worry. And on top of this, the place is so health-giving that you could potentially live up to be 250 years old. Your youth, your physical prime, it might last a solid 100 years in this place rather than just a handful of decades. And the other marker of the community is that really nothing is forbidden. Everything is allowed in moderation. So you're not in a position of total abstemiousness, and yet this is not the French Quarter. You know, experience can be had, but in moderation, and it's a place of plenty. There's no deprivation or political discord, and you're able to pursue all your interests, no matter how esoteric, taking your time over exactly what you would like to take your time over. Obviously, that's a luxury all of us would like. Hilton builds this world and then kind of asks the questions of who would say no to this, and if we say no, what then happens?
So there's a lot going on here with Shangri-La and its appeals and so forth. And one is this key point you mentioned. Time slows down in Shangri-La, so you can live a long time there. There's also a kind of commentary about what that means.
The way it's put in the novel, it's described as a rich and growing enchantment not so much one individual thing that's going on as a gradual revelation of elegance, of modest and impeccable taste, which sounds deeply appealing to me, I can say.
They're also critiquing the West in a sense, aren't they? James Hilton is, and saying life in Europe and the United States is rushed to the point of confusion and nonsense. And there's a suggestion that there's a Western obsession with time. The more you pursue it, the more you lose it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think there's also an element of critique of Western priorities, ladder climbing, imperialism to an extent. And I think Hilton's argument, and certainly the High Lama's argument, is kind of play stupid games, win stupid prizes. So even if as rushed as we are for time in the West, the novel says, we're spending that time badly too.
I was surprised and delighted to see the word slacker in this book. You know, this 1933 novel, I thought slacker was kind of a Gen X slang term, and it is, but it turns out it has a deeper history, and James Hilton was using the term back in the 1930s, more or less the way we would use it now. And Conway, in fact, calls the word slacker a slang word. He says slang for a lazy fellow, a good for nothing. And in this conversation, Chang replies, quote, "It is significant that the English regard slackness as a vice. We, on the other hand, should vastly prefer it to tension. Is there not too much tension in the world at present? And might it not be better if more people were slackers?" He has this question, and Conway agrees with him.
Yeah, frankly, I agree too. One of the lines is that laziness and doing stupid things can be a great virtue. So in a sense, we are told that Conway's attitude and the attitude of the inhabitants of Shangri-La is a true ordering of priorities, a much better ordering of priorities than has been typically seen outside this place.
And this gets to the fundamental appeal of Shangri-La. You know, time slows down, you get to have more leisure in the best sense of it for study and learning and appreciating music and the arts and so much more. And this really appeals to Conway.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, who would it not appeal to? Not only do you get to live in this beautiful place and to live in a vastly expanded lifetime, you have time to pursue every interest. And you're also, as it develops in the novel, you're a guardian of the best of culture from the East and the West. The novel suggests that there is an impending storm that is going to strike the entire world. And it could be something, it's hinted along the lines of nuclear war or something like that, or at least how it would have been understood in the 30s. So even amidst these luxuries at Shangri-La, you're also performing an important function. Because one of the things Conway says is that it's all well and good, but if there's no sense of purpose for him, he can't stick, which makes sense to a lot of us, I think, too. We don't imagine paradise as necessarily a place without any moral duty or any ethical implications for us, but those things may enrich our experience of a utopia.
When Conway and his companions first arrive in Shangri-La, they're immediately wondering, how do we get out of here? How do we get back home? As they spend more time in the place, they start to see its appeal. They start to have different ideas. Some want to stay or think about staying. Others want to get out. And this is a point of friction between them.
Absolutely. Mallinson is essentially the agitator in this. He's a young man. He has a girl back in England. He has parents back in England that he would like to return to. So he is the one agitating to leave Shangri-La. And he also is deeply distrustful of the local people in Chang and Conway to an extent. He had, until this point, until they reached Shangri-La, admired Conway and thought him to be a man of action. And then he's bitterly disappointed with Conway after they arrive. The others, the missionary, Miss Brinklow, and Bernard, he turns out to be a white-collar criminal fleeing. So both of those people have reasons to stay locally. And then the third person, Conway, who wants to stay is because he simply likes it. And he does give that as his reason, that aesthetically it's pleasing to him and it fulfills some of his deepest longings.
one of the initial conversations about Shangri-La's, they're saying, we need to get back to civilization. And I think it's Chang who says, are you so very certain that you are away from it?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the central questions of the novel. What does paradise look like? Who has it figured out?
Now, Conway, our man of action, turns out also to be a man of contemplation. And he's thinking hard about Shangri-La and his future. And eventually he meets Dalai Lama. And this is a guy who is remote. We've been hearing about him, but unable to visit with him, unable to know him. At last, Conway, and only Conway, is granted an audience with the High Lama. First of all, who is the High Lama, and what do they talk about, and why is their conversation so important in the book?
Conway is summoned to the High Lama, who is essentially the boss of the monastery, the most senior member. And as they begin to speak, the High Lama starts spinning a story of this Capuchin monk who came to Shangri-La in the mid-1700s. His name was Father Perhu, I think. I'm probably mispronouncing that. I don't speak French. But Father Perhu, at the time he discovered this place, he wandered and stumbled into it. And eventually he restored this monastery and cultivated the local people too into creating this idyllic farming community. So he's essentially organized this entire thing, this mysterious Capuchin monk. As they are speaking, even in their first conversation, it gradually is dawning on Conway that even though this person would have to be 250 years old to be the same guy he's talking to, it is the same guy he's talking to.
So the High Lama has a hidden identity, and time has slowed down, and he's lived a long, long time.
Yes, absolutely. He has managed to observe so much in the way of history, but he has also, through sheer contemplation, developed clairvoyant powers. So he's able to read Conway's mind, essentially, too.
All right. This whole setting, then, of Shangri-La has really captured the public imagination. I'd heard the place name Shangri-La long before I'd ever heard of this novel, Lost Horizon. And my assumption had been, I suppose, that it was a term from Tibetan mythology or something, an ancient term. But it comes from this book. James Hilton invented it for this book. This book is responsible for its popularity. Why do you think this word and this place has secured such a hold on our imaginations that everybody at some levels heard of Shangri-La?
It's a big question. I think in part because utopia isn't nearly descriptive enough and it's more theoretical, whereas Shangri-La we understand is a place name, but we also understand it as a metaphor. And that's what I mean, that, and the fact that Hilton has given us language for this very broadly understood human concept. And yet, you're right, it did not precede the book. He came up with that. It's one of the ways this novel has changed the world.
The novel and the term gained more popularity when Lost Horizon was made into a movie in 1937, directed by Frank Capra. Is the movie Lost Horizon good? Should people go out and watch it?
Oh, absolutely. And the good news on that point is you can rent it from Amazon Prime Video for $3 today and watch it. People may know the name Frank Capra. He was the director of It's a Wonderful Life, It Happened One Night, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. So an all-time classic movie sort of director, incredibly capable. And this was sort of his white whale of a project. It cost, even in 1930s money, millions of dollars to make. The original cut to the movie was 6 hours long, and Capra later said that he burned the first two reels, as in literally burned them. And then following the box office release of the movie in the late 30s, the film itself became lost so that we did not have a master cut of it. And it had to, we had to launch a worldwide search in the early 1970s to even recover most of the film. It was just, it was the case that the film itself had degraded in what copies we did have, and also that we did not have the complete set of reels. So when you watch it on Amazon Prime now, you'll notice that sometimes the view switches to just a still photo, and to some kind of recorded audio, like the film itself is cutting out and switching to this. And that's because of those remaining missing parts, which is fascinating to me because you see the film having this long, strange trajectory of loss and revitalization, much like the novel itself and what the novel depicts.
Let's talk briefly about the author, James Hilton, born in 1900, dies in 1954. Lost Horizon is a great novel that he wrote. He's well known for another book, a familiar title, also a movie. That's Goodbye, Mr. Chips. The novel came out in 1934. It was so after Lost Horizon, right after Lost Horizon. It was kind of a breakthrough novel for James Hilton. At any rate, tell us a little bit about James Hilton. Who was this guy, and what is Goodbye, Mr. Chips?
So as you said, Hilton was born in 1900. He's an Englishman. His father was a school headmaster, and it's not a coincidence that so much of Hilton's work either takes place in a school or inspired by school relationships. Hilton went to Cambridge, and then he became a novelist and a screenwriter, publishing his first novels very early, I want to say at the age of 20. And he also won an Academy Award for screenwriting. And ultimately, I think he authored as many as 14 novels, and that's not including the nonfiction and the plays. And these were tremendously successful in their own day. Mr. Chips was his breakout hit, coming fairly early in his career. And if people are going to read another Hilton beyond Lost Horizon, I cannot say enough good things about Goodbye, Mr. Chips. This is a book that will make you smile and bring you to tears. And I don't mean that in a soppy way. It's not a sentimental story, but there's a real warmth, generosity, and sweetness to it. It's the story of this beloved teacher at a minor British boarding school who his personal life is marked by tragedy. His wife dies in childbirth. And yet this man still leads generations of boys in a very caring and reserved but fatherly way, even as the larger nation experiences the horrors of the war, the First World War, that is. So it's very sweet without being soppy. And at the end, there's this wonderful scene as the teacher dies saying, "You know, I know that all of you pity me for not having had children, but I had thousands of children and all of them were boys." Very sweet.
Lost Horizon has a special place in the history of book publication. It's sometimes called the first paperback, which isn't quite right. It's the first mass market paperback. At any rate, Kat, why is Lost Horizon an important book in this area?
You're absolutely right. It wasn't the first paperback. It was an early and significant hit in this paperback market. It eventually sold millions of copies. And it was also the choice of reading material for a lot of soldiers in World War II. At the time of World War II, there were these books that were published as what were called ASEs, or Armed Services Editions. And they included Lost Horizon, Great Gatsby was another great and popular one. And they were supplied en masse to American troops in World War II to help them through moments of boredom and discontent. Some of these books were even dropped by parachute on remote Pacific islands. The American soldiers were reading these books in the foxholes. And if anybody wants to learn more about that, there's a book called When Books Went to War, the stories that helped us win World War II. And it really casts light on the fascinating history, not only of Lost Horizon and its role among GIs, but the role of other books too, great works of American and English literature.
Speaking of World War II, this novel, Lost Horizon, and the concept, or at least the name of Shangri-La, influenced Franklin Delano Roosevelt. What's the connection between this book and that president?
Yes, FDR was very struck by Lost Horizon, and he wanted to call the presidential retreat Shangri-La. It's since been called Camp David. But that it even came to the attention of the American president is pretty fascinating. You also had, in Colorado, a wealthy theater owner created his own Shangri-La based on the architecture described in the book.
And one more question as we wrap up. How did you discover the book Lost Horizon by James Hilton? And what's the case for reading it now in the 2020s, almost a century after it was written?
Well, every year, this is going to sound pretty nerdy, but every year I try to read more of the classics. And because Lost Horizon is so short, it seemed like an easy one to tackle. And in that sense, it is an easy read. So it was a way for me to up the total number of books that I read in a year and to become more familiar with, you know, classic works of literature. The case for reading it today, I think, well, you could start there, that it's very short. It's very easy to read. It has tremendous historical significance. It highlights the relationship of the West to the East and all its complexity. It's not necessarily a straightforward relationship at all. There's astounding ethical quandaries involved. And the last thing I think I would say is that for the sheer beauty of the prose and the beauty of the ideas, you can hardly do any better. As little known as the novel is now, it's a grave injustice. I think we can expand ourselves by tapping into even this earlier version of Utopia.
Kat Babb Magiera, thanks for joining us and telling us all about Lost Horizon by James Hilton.
Thank you so much for having me. I love this book, and I hope people get the chance to read it.
You've just listened to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to the Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through our website at heymiller.com on Twitter. My handle is at heymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the Great Books Podcast.